I heard a teacher who said, I have a new pedagogical idea. Let's just stop teaching kids math facts. Let's teach them instead how to use AI well. And he went on and on. And after about, 2 minutes, I thought, is this a satire? Could anybody actually think this way, that we should stop bothering teaching kids multiplication and how to do basic operation? So I actually commented and I said, is this satire? And he commented back, no, I am a real teacher and these are my views. And he's not alone. He's not alone. And I think more and more parents are starting to realize so many schools and so many teachers are just careening down this cliff of relying on technology for everything, outsourcing everything without being able to stop back and think, are you going to be able to even use the technology in a meaningful way?
Hello, and welcome back to the Be Unbound podcast. I'm your co-host, David Rethemeyer.
And I'm your co-host, Jonathan Brush.
And we would like to officially welcome you all to the year 2026, at least as of when you all are listening to this. We are recording this toward the tail end of 2025, but this will be the first episode that we have air in the new year, and we are very, very excited about all of the content that we have coming here on the podcast. And we are beyond excited to be introducing the first guest that we have to kick off this year's episode, who is Andrew Pudua.
Well, Andrew says in this episode that he has a little bungalow of a brain, and so we'll let you, dear listener, decide if you agree with that. I don't know that David and I particularly thought that, because first of all, if that's the case, then we weren't really sure what kind of dwelling our brains represented, but it was probably lower than a bungalow. But Andrew is always a pleasure and honor to talk to. He has deep and penetrating insights into lots of things. From my perspective, he is one of the foremost educators alive and operating in the world today, and I realize that's a bold claim. But I don't make that because, we're friends with Andrew, or we like Andrew. Both of those things are true. I say that because well before either of those things happened, that we were friends with Andrew, we knew Andrew well enough to like him personally, I watched the impact that he had on the lives of countless students that I was working with, often through Unbound, but through other places as well, and my own children. And Andrew is an extraordinarily talented teacher and presenter and thinker. And anytime you get a chance to talk to him, it's mind and body and soul enhancing. And today was no exception. And we hope you enjoy this conversation as much as David and I had having it. Andrew Pudua, welcome back to the Be Unbound podcast. It's always fun to see you. It's more fun to see you in person, like we just did at Base Camp recently in Pennsylvania. But anytime we can see you, even virtually, it's a real thrill for us, and especially when we get to have a chance to sort of set some time aside for some uninterrupted conversation, in this case, a recorded one, but still some uninterrupted conversation. And I want to pick up with some things that have some threads that have come together for me recently. And then Andrew, we were just talking and you had an excellent quote that I want you to kick off with. But, we tell people that to ignore the impact of AI at this point is educational malpractice. And what I mean by that is that AI is a significant factor in the world today. Now, how significant and what the long-term effects are, I think that's all very open, and I've got various mixed ideas to sort of change maybe daily on that. But we see some of that impact, and I saw it in a couple of interesting ways recently. We've done a couple webinars, and we've talked several times about an article that was on a Substack about a guy who talked about how most of his college students were just not able to function at the college level. And the feedback he got to his article was 99% of educators said the same thing. And it was striking to us that we would say the exact opposite. We were the 1%. Our students don't act like that. This morning, I taught one of our local equip groups, which is a fun thing I get to do. And the students in that equip group are the exact opposite. They are extremely articulate, extremely good thinkers, good writers. And that's the point. They're voracious readers and writers. And I'd love to take credit for that, but they were voracious readers and writers before they came to me. And that difference is really apparent, even against their peers that I work with in other settings. And so to me, what is somewhat striking here is there's this widening gap between those who can think and those who can't. And that's marked almost primarily by two major disciplines, reading and writing. And the final is a little personal, which is I had been at the point where I was reading pretty consistently 75 books a year for years, like 10, 15 years. And then I got busy, and then I started to be tired at the end of the day and watch a little YouTube video and then another YouTube video and another YouTube video. And I'm actually pretty scared to count the amount of books I read this year because I bet, here we are, late December, I bet I'm sub 15. I might be sub 10. And the reason that was apparent to me is because recently I read a book, and it had been a while since I read a book, and I could feel almost instantly my thinking change. And there was two ways. One, it was much harder to start to read the book than it has ever been for me before. And then second, after I did read the book, I almost had this flood of recognition of old thought patterns that had been obliterated that I'd missed. So that's a longer preamble than we usually do, but I wanted to set this up because, Andrew, you started us off a little bit ago with an absolutely excellent quote from, I believe, Bacon. And if you could start again with that and then continue on, that'd be great.
Yeah, I would make a comment about what you just said and then share this Bacon quote. We have a mutual acquaintance, Lee Bortons, who I gave a little talk, and she said, the Industrial Revolution brought really two classes into existence that really didn't exist in the same way they did before, and that was the haves and the have-nots. And it was the people who have that leverage that power. Then with the Information Revolution, we had the math and the math-nots, right? People who knew and understood and could do math, and people who didn't. And those were the people who then leveraged that into creating all the technology of the last century. And then we have now the AI revolution, and we will have the thinks and the think-nots. And I thought that was just a very simple way to put it in kind of an historical perspective. And indeed, I agree with you. It's the people who are going to be able to listen and speak and read and write and think that hopefully are going to be able to leverage that for worse, hopefully for better, in whatever's coming in the next decades. We don't really know because things seem to be changing faster than ever before. So that's a, I think, a key thought to hold in mind. Do you want to be in that category of the thinks, the people who do it and know how to do it, can leverage it, and everyone else? One analogy I like to use when people bring this, we've got to get AI in schools. We've got to let, I actually heard, Jonathan, talk about scrolling on TikTok. I heard a teacher who said, I have a new pedagogical idea. Let's just stop teaching kids math facts. Let's teach them instead how to use AI well. And he went on and on. And after about, 2 minutes, I thought, is this a satire? Could anybody actually think this way, that we should stop bothering teaching kids multiplication and how to do basic operations? So I actually commented and I said, is this satire? And he commented back, no, I am a real teacher and these are my views. And he's not alone. He's not alone. And I think more and more parents are starting to realize so many schools and so many teachers are just careening down this cliff of relying on technology for everything, outsourcing everything without being able to stop back and think, are you going to be able to even use the technology in a meaningful way? So the analogy I like to point out is, okay, yes, let's all agree, calculators can do math faster and more accurately than you and I can. Okay. And that's been true for, half a century over. But take two people. One person has learned math. They can do a little bit of math. They could do a problem like, 26 times 3 in their head. They understand basic principles of algebra. They can think in fractions and percentages. They don't need technology, at least, to do that. And then you got another person who can't figure out 6 times 7 minus 2, without a calculator. Of course, you need to know where the parentheses are there if you don't know your operation. But nevertheless, who's going to use the calculator better? Obviously, the person. And I think back to my father, who was an engineer and helped send satellites into space. And, He got a HP35 calculator, and it did exponents and logarithms, and he thought he'd just died and gone to heaven. But you know what? He always used a slide rule to check the calculator and be sure the answer was correct. So I think we're at that point in language now. We could agree that ChatGPT or whatever you like can put together facts and spit out language that is probably more correct, if you want to use that term, at least in terms of, you know, spelling and grammar and format and all that, better than most people. So now, why should we continue to teach it? So that sets us up. So the quote that I've been very excited and using a bit in my talks and whatnot is from Francis Bacon's essay on studies. And in that short essay, it's something everyone should read. Everyone should read that. And I don't like everything about Bacon. He was kind of, you know, knowledge is power. Let's use knowledge to control everything and everybody. That was kind of a little off the track, I would say. But he had a lot of super valuable contributions. And in his essay on studies, he says, reading maketh, you got to say maketh, because, you know, Shakespearean period, maketh a full man, human. So reading maketh a full man, discourse or conference, I think is the word as it was translated as I got it, was maketh a ready man, and writing maketh an exact man. And so indeed, we look at the furnishing of the mind, the recollecting, the recollecting up of ideas, organizing them, and then expressing them in writing gives you this demand for precision of thought that you almost don't get any other way.
So I think it's interesting because as you said that, I was thinking about your father checking the calculator with the slide rule. And I was kind of chuckling. It's not the same level, but I have more than a few times checked a spreadsheet with a calculator. Mainly because I'm not entirely sure that I've gotten the formulas correct. And then it's like, sometimes I'm like, oh, that's right. And sometimes I'm like, is that right? And so, but I was thinking about, like, let's reverse that quote, Andrew. So reading maketh a full man. So, you know, what will be the empty of a full man would be an empty man. And so I think of somebody who watches YouTube all the time. And when I'm thinking of that person, I'm thinking about the mirror. You know, as I was joking with my students earlier today, the one student said that, you know, she felt empty when she watched TV. And she doesn't watch very much TV. And I was thinking as she said that, for almost all my life, my little self-righteous claim was that, you know, I grew up, my parents didn't have a TV. We didn't have a TV. Didn't grow up without a TV. And I thought, you know, I don't watch TV. I don't pay for TV now. I've never paid for cable. Don't watch TV. And then I thought, I had this twinge, and I thought, yeah, but if you went over the last, not so much the last 3 months, but the last few months before then, and you added up my YouTube time, I wouldn't be ashamed to show you anything I watched on YouTube. But I also can tell you that I don't know that I've had any thoughts from that that were transferable. You know, in other words, I didn't learn anything. And so what it represents then is a colossal waste of time, even as it felt. And I've had a conversation with my daughter, Ashley, about this. I said, you know, it's interesting. If I were to show you all the videos I watched, it would look educational. They are. They're about building things. Sometimes they're about history. I mean, I'm watching, I mean, not that I never watch, but I'm not watching fail videos. You know, I'm not watching that kind of stuff. And yet, you know, if I had read those things, I would have all these things to talk about. And yes. Yet I don't have anything to talk about. So, you know, YouTube maketh an empty man. And if you continue that on, you know, if you said discourse maketh a ready man, well, if you think about somebody who, you know, interacts with a video game all the time, that's kind of the definition of an unready man, especially from a masculine standpoint, but you could say an unready person. And then writing maketh an exact man. I would say somebody who uses AI all the time to do their writing is at the very least inexact, since their thoughts are distorted tremendously through the process of writing the AI prompt, because what you get out the other side is not your own thinking, but a generalization, even if you've entered some of your own material, you know, to make it more realistic. So, sorry, Andrew, I cut you off there.
No, that's so true. And we do easily fall into watching something and imagine that we're learning things. But it's very different when something is kind of continuously coming at you. And a lot of these YouTube videos will have, you know, they'll have a decent script, but they decorate it with just constant flashing images. Whereas a book, it really forces you to create your own images in your own imagination. So if you think of reading and you read a, you know, if you're reading a novel, you're getting character development, you're getting place and time, you're getting little clues as to what that might be like. And then you yourself in your own mind have to pull from your memory, construct those images and concepts and hold them in your awareness while you are reading the book. There's nothing that's going to pre-imagine that for you. Same thing, you know, we've all read a book and watched the movie of the book, or vice versa. And, you know, what I notice is that very often if I read the book, I'll have some really interesting imaginations going on. I'll go back to reflect on it. But then if I watch the movie, it kind of overwrites my imaginations and they become less mine. So it's less the author using language to transfer ideas and concepts and images and experiences and emotions and all that stuff. Movies just don't do that in the same way. It's kind of like, well, I don't know, this doesn't sound appealing, but pre-digested food, right? You know, This constant visual hyper stimulation is like, you know, what they feed the old people, Ensure or something. You know, they can't digest anything, so they have to get, you know, food that doesn't have to be digested. Well, that's not good for your body. Same thing, I don't think it's good for your mind. And what I notice is that it is harder to just read for half an hour and do nothing else than it used to be for me, you know, even 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago. And I think if it's that hard for me, what about these poor kids that never lived without screens, never lived without that constant intrusion on what I would call imagination and memory? And like you said, you can watch a whole video, maybe you remember one thing. But when you read a chapter and then take the time to talk about it with someone, it has a completely different effect on your cognition. And we know there's a huge difference neurologically. You can look at fMRI scans of people reading versus fMRI scans of people watching, and it's 10 to 1. The brain activity is so much greater.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I would say, and we can move on, but I wanted to squeeze this in, the quality of the language that you are likely to encounter in a book or a well-written article or text or short story of some sort is generally at a higher level than what you would hear if people are just, you know, watching a podcast, watching a video. We talk, we have to say something now. We don't have necessarily the time to pause for 2 or 3 seconds and think about the best word to say next. We're dependent on the time crunch of conversation. When you're writing, and I'm sure everyone's experienced this, you write, you can stop in the middle of a sentence and really consider what's the best word to transmit in the most honest and meaningful way my idea to the reader. So there's a leisure of time when it comes to reading and writing that doesn't seem to exist in any other format.
Well, Andrew, what's interesting about what you just said about how so much of the time with those who thoughtfully engage with writing and with other creative mediums is that when we think about how AI actually works, is that it's just taking all of this other pre-existing information and then condensing it and just coming up with something new that is tailored specifically for what you are asking for. And the huge difference there between that sort of writing and the sort of writing that is produced by someone who is taking the time to write it out themselves is that when you are writing by yourself without any sort of other external aid, you're drawing from your own experiences. You're drawing from your own inspirations, your previous experiences, other things that you have read, other things that you have seen and felt emotionally. And the AI is simply drawing from what other people have written from having done that themselves. And so there is no actual real-world experience that is going into that when it is generated like that. And at this point, there is so much of the content that is being produced and just so much of the way that students now are being encouraged or end up just feeling as though they should produce content is just in this way that, well, this is just meeting the prompt of the assignment exactly. This is meeting the assignment of the work that I meant to do exactly, but they don't have the sort of backbone of the real world experiences that can actually make that meaningful. As an example, something that I do, one of my hobbies is that I smoke meats and enjoy sharing them with my family. I love doing that. And a lot of the time when I get on social media, because the social media algorithms know that I enjoy making meats, they will serve me videos about people who are doing that. And on one level, like, there is a part of that where it is educational for me because I can see people who have access to a lot higher level of equipment than me and are able to try things that I would never have the courage to try and to feed it for themselves rather than what I would try to feed to my family. Yet at the same time, there is a part of that where I'm not actually engaging. I'm able to look at that with some of the experiences that I've based it on. But in reality, like this, it's just sort of this imagination of the possibilities of what could be. And so there's a limited amount of benefit that I can get from that as in comparison to what if I just went and did that myself. And so there has to be some level of base experiences that you're drawing from and able to have sort of that fullness that we've been talking about.
Yeah, one of the dangers I perceive, and Jonathan, you touched on this briefly in the beginning, is the problem if you use the technology to write something for you, you didn't wrestle with it. It did. And now the temptation is to fall into thinking, well, that's what I thought, right? I came up with those ideas. I put that together when actually you didn't, but you put your name on it, you send it, you use it, you claim it. And so it's really, I think, almost an insidious temptation to self-deception in that same way. And I find the smoking meats really interesting because we always like to learn from other people. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's value there. But if we exclusively do that without like wrestling, experimenting, right? Communication is a big experiment. Writing is a big experiment. Smoking meats, doing art, everything. And if we take out the experimental part of the process, that's where we lose the humanity. That's where the soul gets disconnected from the process, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was what I was thinking here is that, you know, what is the practical turn here? Because I think that there's a danger at this point where you have a lot of people saying, boy, I'm observing this and I'm seeing this. And that's good. That's the first step, to observe it and to see it and to know what's going on. The second, of course, is to say, well, what is possible here? And I'm struck, you know, that we live less in Orwell's 1984, where the government has, you know, taken over and is a power play, which is not to say that's not happening, but more in Huxley's Brave New World, where we're choosing to do many of the things that are crippling us. And the parallel for me is that, you know, you kick back a couple of generations and people say, wow, you know, you just didn't have these obesity problems. You didn't have all this. Now that's a very complicated, wide-ranging discussion, and I'm not trying to distill it down and miss the nuance and importance there. But, you know, part of the reason you didn't have an obesity problem is because people were walking. Like they didn't have cars, right? And part of it, if you had the obesity problems, is because, you know, you had to get out and make your own food, and that involved growing it or chasing it down and killing it, and so that's good from a, you know, no obesity problem standpoint. As somebody who has some direct experience with both chasing down and killing food and also growing it myself, I'm fairly delighted with our circumstances that allows me to have some different choices, right? I mean, as a backpacker, I know that backpacking is a really fun hobby, but I really like driving for the things I have to do versus having to walk there. And so, however, what that has done is that there is a level of consciousness in our world now that to not actively think about your physical health will result in entropy, will result in decline, and will result in some really bad outcomes. You have to consciously think about what you put in your body in terms of food. You have to consciously think about the diet that you pursue. You have to consciously think about the exercise regime that you go through. You have to consciously look for that effort. And that makes sense to us. And there is a divide. I was thinking, Andrew, about your earlier example, you know, the divide between the thinks and the think nots. I mean, there's a divide between those who are willing to accept that responsibility and those who don't, and they have very different health outcomes. And I know there's exceptions, but broadly speaking, that can be a true statement. I'm struck by the fact that we're now entering a situation where that same logic is applying to thinking. You know, it's going to be unimaginable that you would have to think your own way through school. You have to do all those kinds of things when you can outsource it to an AI. And will that come with some good things? Well, I'm sure it will. I mean, that there will be some advantages and some things. And we've even talked about our own business that there's some places where, you know, if we can have AI book all the flights for one of our student events, that would allow the people that we have booking all those flights to do more student-related functions. That's a pretty powerful human-connecting thing, right? I mean, that's a technology that I could say would be extremely helpful. However, there's going to come with an awareness that if you do that and you outsource it, you're going to have an obesity of the mind that is at least as disturbing as, you know, what inaction will do to you physically. And you know, people who have physical issues because of lack of activity, their richness of life looks very different from those who don't. And the same thing would happen on mental state.
So much so. Technology basically buys you time, right? So you think about the innovations that have made cleaning and housekeeping much easier than it was 100 years ago. You think about the fact that you can go to a supermarket and get good, healthy food if you want to. Amazon will deliver anything you can imagine. You know, you can find information very quickly compared to the old days. I don't know if you're old enough, Jonathan, but I grew up with a card catalog in the library.
I have used that example in many things because, yes, I also had card catalogs. So, David is smiling because he didn't.
I've heard the stories from my parents.
Yes. What we need to do is set up a library that's a museum of how people had to get information a long time ago, just as a curiosity. But so get to that. Technology buys you time. Probably the most important question is, how are you going to use that time? And unfortunately, the commercial mechanisms that are selling you the technology are giving you more time that allows them to sell you entertainment. And so now the line between, you know, eating well and not eating well is all driven by commercial inputs. Reading well and not reading well is all driven by what comes to you. And that furnishing the mind, I love that term, furnishing the mind, because you think, okay, we all have a different brain. I mean, some of us, you know, have a great mansion of a mind, and others like me have a humble little bungalow of a brain. But that's not the most important part. The most important thing is what's in it, right? What did you furnish it with? So if you have useful and beautiful and elegant and soul-enriching content in the mind that you have, you're way better off than having a big mansion with, you know, a bunch of, you know, what, boxes to sit on and screens to stare at. So I hope that we can get more and more young people to who are, and there is this trend, you know, toward eat whole foods and you'll feel better. So can we transfer that and say, contemplate real things, contemplate that which was produced by great minds, whether it's music or literature or art or film, right? And you'll fill your mind and it'll be a happier place for you to live in.
Traditional education doesn't work for everyone. If you or your student wants something different, check out Ascend by Unbound. With flexible courses, real-world projects, mentorship, and community, Ascend equips young adults to thrive academically, professionally, and personally. Students consistently say that the close-knit support and resume-ready experience are their favorite parts. Enrollment prices rise soon, so don't wait. Find your track at beunbound.us/ascend.
I'm hesitating here because there's an entire other podcast in this next turn of thought, but I feel like at the very least we should turn it and explore it a little bit. I've been spending a lot of time, and in fact, I just had a meeting this morning with somebody, and we were wrestling with this a little bit. You mentioned that the people that are selling us time are endeavoring to fill it with more things that they sell, which is entertainment. And I think from a practical standpoint, one of the questions that might be helpful for us to ask ourselves is that what is the opportunity cost of entertainment? And you know, when you said the card catalog, I was laughing because I was also thinking when you said about, you know, housework, I actually, as a young child, one of my jobs was to work the backside of a Ringer washer. In other words, my parents had a Ringer washing machine, which for those of you who don't know, means that you had to stand there while the machine washed, and then you pulled them out and you ran them through a Ringer because it didn't have a spin cycle, right? And so I actually get a thrill every single time we use our washing machine because I'm not on the backside of the Ringer. And so there is an appreciation of life that comes from that, and there is a definite time savings. But then I was the line of thought here went, but that time savings that I'm not standing pulling the clothes out from the backside of the Ringer washer, the exemplary way to say that would be, so I used it to write, to enrich my mind, to read, to build something, to craft something, to work on something. Was it that, or did you become entertained and seek entertainment? And so I think that there's an interesting question there. It's a very, very startling contrast to almost any previous time in history in terms of net time spent in entertainment. And the thing that, you know, we spend time talking with our students, but there's a difference between joy and happiness. Happiness is sort of superficial. There's something rich and deep about joy. And something strangely, joy is on the far side of sorrow. Like you can't really experience full joy. There is something different between creativity and entertainment. There's something different between actively building and making something, which is deeply satisfying and enriching. And Andrew, you and I, we might have, maybe it was our last podcast we talked about this. There's something different between a hobby where you sail a boat or build an airplane versus entertainment where you watch somebody else sail a boat or build an airplane. And yep. they're close enough that I think most people are unquestioningly accepting them as synonymous, when in fact the gulf between them, I think, is terrific. There's a huge chasm between those two things and a big difference.
So. Yeah. I have been tracking, of course, family expenses with Quicken since it came out. So, you know, it's a good thing to know how you use your resources. But I actually made a separate expense category, entertainment and recreation. So when the family would do something that would be in that category of enriching personal experience, going someplace, building something, that was recreation. Going to a movie or watching something, that was entertainment. And so in my mind, I've tried to keep those separate as much as possible. But here's the lie I think we've all bought into. We live in this hard, hard world. We're always working so hard. We're always busy. We're always tired. And the only solution is to relax and be entertained. And so we justify that based on our perception of how hard the world lives in, you know, how hard the world is that we live in, when really what we need is a little bit of perspective with a ring washer to understand the world we live in is actually phenomenally easy compared to almost every single other time in history. But we've been, again, you know, programmed, brainwashed, if you will, into believing that you deserve a break today, you know, so you go to McDonald's and you watch a movie. You know, that's how you re-energize. That's how you relax. But most people would notice that if they ate at McDonald's and watched a movie, they would be more tired at the end of it than they were before. So mostly, I think young people today, when they do have a chance, and you see this every time you guys get together and talk to your people, when they make something, that's the most energizing thing you can do, is get together with people and build something, create something, make something, design something, do a play, read to each other, have a little mini formal debate on something. You come out of that I'm ready now for the next thing in life. So if we can, as much as possible, encourage young people and their parents to make that distinction. I'm not saying entertainment doesn't have its place, but the fact that entertainment has eclipsed recreation is, I think, of great danger to young people today.
Just that last part of that creativity, I think of, you know, you watch a funny skit on YouTube and, you know, and you watch it collectively. There's a bit of a shared experience. But I know that we host a group of people that comes to our house every Thursday night, and there can be 30 to 70 people there. And we do this little challenge. And if there's a skit night, which I have too many youth group memories of skits. There's PTSD starts for me. When we say skit night, I just immediately start to cringe. But for all those of you listening who come to my house on Thursday night, I've never cringed on a Thursday night. Instead, I've laughed myself silly. Andrew, you and I were, and David, we were at a skit night years ago at a base camp in the Gulf Shores. And let's just say the humor was questionable, but we were all laughing so hard that we were crying. And there's something very different participating in that, you know, where there's a creative aspect where you know the people who had to put effort in, and maybe you had to put effort in as well to do your own little skit. Is the quality the same as that skit on YouTube? Well, not if you're watching a paid trained comedian, but is the enrichment better? I mean, one sticks and one doesn't. One's empty calories and one's, you know, useful food. And that's interesting to think about and to sort of, you know, it's that insertion of creativity. It's that insertion of work. It's that insertion of effort that makes a huge difference there.
Well, so. And in a way, that's kind of like the soul, right? It's the soul that goes in and gives it that spark of life. And I heard, I wanted to squeeze this in because I think this is one of the most significant aspects of AI that should be addressed. And that is how people use AI in different generations. And I think it was Sam Altman who said this, but it was one of these AI tech guys who said, well, what we observe in the way people use AI, old people, that would be me, primarily use it as a search engine. So that's basically the only thing I've ever done is try to get some information. I don't trust it, so then I have to go verify it in some other way, and I still don't trust it. But that's the only thing that I have really done so far. The next generation down, kind of the millennials, they are more likely to use it as an operating system. Like you said, schedule all the flights for my team, or, you know, plan my menu and tell me what ingredients to buy and then order them and have them delivered. And I don't have to do any of that. And it's a time saver. The one that really bothered me was young people in your, you know, 25 and under. Their most common use of AI is as a companion or a counselor. So they're asking AI for life advice. They're asking AI what to do about their problems. This I find very, very disturbing because, as you know, David said, it can't know anything. It can only put together the most likely combination of words that have been used. And so then you're asking for heart for your soul. You're asking for help for your soul from a soulless thing. And that I find just very, very unnerving and frightening, quite honestly.
We've actually talked to our students and our staff about this. And I said, the reality is that from a Christian perspective, we believe the world has fallen. And so we believe that, you know, serious Christians are always some form of a remnant, which means that anything that gets broad at adoption is going to result in more pain and sin than not. So in other words, has the internet done good for people? Yes, it's created enormous wealth. I mean, there's tremendous things we can say about all the good things the internet did. I don't think that's even a competition to line it up against all the awful things it's done. You know, if you look at all the impact, is that, you know, have, you know, firearms made a difference in the world? Certainly. I mean, if you talk about hunting or, you know, kind of there's I'm a person who grew up with guns and shooting and all that kind of stuff, and I can talk about positives. But, you know, net, it you know, industrialized killing, right? I mean, so there's, you know, will AI, are there good things to use in AI? Yes, and we should go after them. I mean, like, and we should use them. But we should not be surprised if the net result is that it actually brings a lot more evil into the world. And I would then follow up with that with not a comment of hopelessness, but a clarion call to arms for such a time as this. I mean, that's the generation that we're put into. That's the challenge that we have. This is the particular thing that we're facing. And the hope that we have eclipses even that, which doesn't mean that it's going to be temporarily fixed, but it will be long-term.
I totally agree. I was going to throw this out. Maybe it's worth saying, maybe you should edit it, but you know, all through history, people have talked about the Antichrist, right? So what is that? Well, I've had this thought. Okay, you've got these AI, right? Most people consider it to be kind of omniscient, right? Anything you don't know, you can ask, it can find out. And even if it can't, it's going to pretend that it did and give you an answer. And so our perception is that it's more omniscient than anything we know. It's also omnipresent, right? You can have it all the time, anytime you want. And sometimes you have it even when you don't want it. It's there behind the scenes. So it's omnipresent. And then people are saying, well, it's going to be able to do everything that most anyone can do, and you put it into robots, and then it's going to be able to do everything that anyone can do. And so then it becomes omnipotent. So if you look at something that is omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent, but has no soul, has no reality, wouldn't that be pretty close to the definition of an antichrist?
At least to the point that that we should do what we ought to do anytime we're faced with new technology and anytime we're faced with new things, which is to, you know, the term we use in Unbounds, to be deliberate. In other words, can we think about how we're using this? Can we decide? And I say that not as a warning, because I think that's what people want. And when you get a warning, you tend to want to go, it's not for me. I say it more as an encouragement and a reminder that God has given you the ability to make decisions. That God has given you the ability to think and discern. And it is not necessary for you to say yes to everything the culture or the people tell you to do. And we as Christians should believe and understand that better than anybody else. I think this about kids like, well, you know, technology just gets to kids. Well, yeah, I mean, if you let kids use technology. I do not cede the ground that my child has to have a cell phone at 14. I don't see that that's necessary. Nobody's forcing me to do that. And therefore, I choose not to do it. I don't cede the ground that my child has to watch TV. We don't. You know, I don't cede the ground that my child has to have a TikTok account. They don't. That's unnecessary. I don't cede the ground that my child should have toys that have batteries and make noises for the most part. Now, far-flung relatives don't always think the same. So we have an interesting little thing where after Christmas, there's an amazing tragedy that happens to most of the battery-driven things that come into my house. But the point is, I have a choice to do that, right? Like that, I have an ability to do that. And that ability is worth being reminded of because, you know, if you were granted with such amazing powers by being made in the image of God that you could have that ability, what would you do if you were against that, to your point, Andrew? Well, the only thing you could do is to work really hard to make people forget they had it.
Yeah.
And that's that blindness is something that is real. But in this case, you haven't been blinded. You've been told to close your eyes. And you can just open them.
Yeah. The thing that gives me so much hope is kids like David, right? I mean, your young people in the Unbound program as a whole, and I don't know all of them, but the ones I do know and the group experience I've had, that is, to me, like the hope of the future because they can influence their peers. They will influence their peers way more than I will ever influence young people in that same way. And this is why I think it's so vital that we continue this work of saying, what are the distinctly human things? The reading, you know, the conversations that mean something, the task of writing and honing, refining, distilling thoughts, and living in that world of the mind, the heart, the imagination, because that's what will inspire other people, right? And when you see a real person doing a real thing, your natural inclination, especially as a young person, is to say, I would love to be able to do that. and then move in that direction. When you see something fantastical on a screen, or someone who's like super good at something, but you don't even know, did they really do that? You can't believe anything anymore. There's no inspiration in that. And so the idea of getting young people together, engaging in the conversation, having them, you know, build and work and share their talents and their experience and their passion for life with each other, that's what's going to change other young people, not you and me talking on a podcast, unfortunately, although we wish it did.
Well, that gives us an excellent place to end. So just if you're listening now, we just want to summarize this for you. So the answers here is that you should enroll in Unbound, and it's David's responsibility. And
so, great. So no point, pressure whatsoever.
It's on you, David. And with that, we'll go forth. Andrew and I are going to go take a nap, and David has a lot of work to do. So.
Yeah, great. I love that conclusion. If I may offer a slightly different conclusion,
sure.
That really, I think, well, Andrew, what you said rings very, very true. And I think that when young people, I think that the students in Unbound get to see this firsthand, when young people engage with something that is real and inspiring and gives them experiences that allow them to have the drive to pursue risky things, to enrich their life, to have that fullness, it's so much of a different feeling of satisfaction, of joy, of inspiration than you get from just watching someone doing something cool on a screen. When you have some sort of experience, when you get inspired to do something in your real life, in the real world, it's just a completely different level of that. It's a completely different level of recreation. There are many times when you can go out and you can do something after a very full, long day of work, and you can do something very active that you may be tired in one sense at the end of your workday, but going out and doing that recreation is even more energizing on another level. And that's just a truth that is just so easy to miss, because the cheap thrills, the cheap entertainment, the cheap quote-unquote recreation is very easily accessible. But if you're willing to push a little bit further past that, and I think that we see that a lot of the time with our students, there is so much more richness that can be developed and so much more depth that can allow you to feel full as a person.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on and for taking your time to be with us. It's always a pleasure. And I'm not sure if I agree with your bungalow of brain assessment, but if it is a bungalow, it's a particularly well-furnished one with some high-quality wood in there. And so we appreciate you sharing it with us and opening it up for us. Thank you, Andrew. Always a pleasure and honor to have you on.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, David. It is always a joy. Keep up the good work, and hopefully it won't be too long till I see you again.
Looking forward to it. Well, David, there's so many things to say after that conversation with Andrew, but I was thinking about the fact that we were talking a little bit earlier that we got to end our recording year 2025 with Andrew, which is fun, and we get to kick off our podcast year 2026 and airing this. But that means that this airs just a few days before we go to Ridgeline, which is our third live event in our Ascend program, which is our flagship post-high school program for Unbound. And Andrew had this great line there. He said, where, you know, you get a lot of fulfillment out of building and making things. And for us, Ridgeline is that event where there's a lot of things built
so
and
many
made.
Building and makings happening.
And so if you are at all interested in the kinds of things that Andrew talked about, and you're interested in what it's like to have that kind of recreate or recreate or to create or to build or to make, then two things. You should go to our YouTube channel. I know that's a little bit ironic after what we just said, but you go to our YouTube channel and search for Ridgeline and watch the wrap up from last year. There's a 60-second version and a 15-minute version. And you should keep an eye on that space for the wrap up that will come probably in February from this one, because there's a lot of really big projects planned this year, David. Mm-hmm. One of which is, and this kind of ties into what we talked about as well, is that we're doing something we've never done before, David. We're going to Ridgeline and we're not buying the camp's food program. In other words, we're not having meals served by the camp, because one of our student projects is to cook the meals for the entire rest of the camp while they are there. And they have some really, really ambitious, fantastic stuff planned. And so, you know, if you have think what Andrew said made sense, take a moment to check out beunbound.us. Take a look at some of our programs and particularly pay a little attention to Ridgeline, because the things that he talked about, we're actually going to get to put into practice here in just a few short weeks.
It is going to be an absolute blast, and I cannot wait to see how all of the projects get executed. But yeah, I think it connects very well with what Andrew said in this podcast. And really just we hope that all of you are encouraged not only to check out programs like ours, where young people get to experience and be enriched by doing things in the real world, but that you're also inspired in your everyday lives to just take a little bit of a risk and to push a little bit past some of the discomfort that you be involved in taking the less trodden path of trying to find new experiences and new ways to engage in the world around you. And we hope that this is inspiring to you to engage in that and to have the fuller life that we believe that God has in store for you if you're willing to chase it.
Welcome to 2026. We're looking forward to the adventures ahead. And until next time, be unbound.
Hi, my name is Stephen Hall. I'm from New York, and I'm currently enrolled in Ascend Year 2 from Unbound. This year, I completed my first year in the Ascend program, and it was one of the best experiences of my life. Before joining Ascend, I was feeling kind of stuck. I had a lot of ideas about what I wanted to do after high school, but I wasn't confident in how to actually move forward into the real world. I didn't have a clear direction, and I felt like I was being pressured by expectations I didn't know how to fill. I kept hearing that going to college and getting an expensive degree was the only way to be successful. But the Ascend program changed all of that for me. From the very first day, the Navigate and Leadership courses provided useful and practical insights that I could implement right away in my work, my church, and in my life in general. Ascend was a launch pad for me into the real world. It gave me confidence to make the big decisions, and it equipped me to be a leader among my peers. Since going through Ascend Foundations, I have been operating a team of my own at work, and I find myself using the lessons I learned from Ascend on a daily basis to keep it running smoothly and efficiently. But the impact that Ascend had on my life went far beyond the academic or the vocational. And that is because the heart of Ascend is the people. The Unbound staff are phenomenal. They are passionate and relatable, and they genuinely care about every student's personal growth. My team was also incredible, and I can honestly say now that most of my closest friends are from Ascend. These students aren't afraid to ask the hard questions, and I have never had so many deep conversations in my life. I don't know at this point what career I'm going to go into. I don't know how much money I'm going to make. But going through Ascend has given me the confidence to step forward in faith into what God is calling me to do today. And it has given me an amazing community that I could have never even dreamed of. I can't wait to see what this next year has in store, and I hope I'll see you there.